And our sermon text, then, is Daniel chapter 7. And because of its relative length, I think I'm going to read it as I read many of the chapters in the book of Job. That is, point by point. But go ahead and turn in your Bibles, then, to Daniel chapter 7. It's Christmas season again, Advent season. And as I ponder it, I think maybe God was providential in just having us through Sarah sing more Advent music, you know, which is always a delight for me. But during this time of year, it is Christmas season, and I think of one of my favorite movies, Christmas Story, about a kid growing up in a wintry Midwestern town in the 50s, right in my wheelhouse. It begins a few weeks or so before Christmas, where Ralph, the main character, is a 10 or 11-year-old boy who wants nothing more than his long-sought-after Red Ryder BB gun for Christmas. And great fun ensues as he goes to school, wards off bullies, enjoys all the American middle-class traditions of the Christmas season. One of my favorite vignettes is with his little orphan Annie's secret decoder ring. I want to get one of those as we work in Revelation. You know, maybe I can get some more insight into it. Ralph was a fan of the radio broadcast, Little Orphan Annie, and he'd listen breathlessly to her adventures with pirates and spies and bad guys of every kind. He even sent away for the Little Orphan Annie's secret decoder ring. And this item was so that you, too, can decode the secret messages sent by Annie on her weekly broadcast. You got to see this movie. And by this ring, you gained entry into Annie's secret circle. You were special. You were privy to knowledge no one else had. When his ring finally arrived, Ralph waited expectantly to the next broadcast of Little Orphan Annie. He said, "It's my first secret meeting." The announcer said, "Don't tell anyone. Only members of Annie's secret circle can decode Annie's secret message. Remember, Annie is depending on you." And so Ralph repairs to the bathroom with his ring to decode the numbers read on air. "The fate of the planet may hang in the balance," he thought. "The tension was unbearable. My fingers flew. My mind was a steel trap." What was the message, do you think? Mao is about to overthrow Chiang Kai-shek in China. Cuba is secretly smuggling in ballistic missiles from the Soviet Union. Eisenhower is surrounded by communists in his administration. No. Not exactly. Even though all these things were later proven to be true in Ralph's boyhood, it's not what Ralph was told by Little Orphan Annie. No, his message? Be sure to drink your Ovaltine. I see some of you have been over this too, right? Be sure to drink your Ovaltine. One of Ralph's great disillusionments in life at that moment. He says, a crummy commercial? After uttering an expletive, he resignedly opens the bathroom door and then he goes down to dinner, disillusioned but all the wiser. Now, this is a little bit exaggerated, a little bit hyperbolic, but a lot of Christians approach Revelation and Daniel, both books that fall into the genre of apocalyptic, with the same attitude of Ralph to Little Orphan Annie's secret messages. The messages of Daniel and Revelation are so enigmatic and to some indecipherable that they require special knowledge. A Revelation decoder ring, maybe, to interpret them, right? But by this knowledge, the reader enters into John's secret circle. You're special. You become privy to knowledge no one else has. Consequently, these books and others of the genre apocalyptic have become objects of obsession and endless interpretation for millennia. Some have been very close to the truth intended by the authors. We'll go through some of these in days to come. Others as fanciful and absurd as Ralph's decoder ring. Be sure to drink your Ovaltine. So there's that be sure to drink your Ovaltine school of interpretation out there. And hopefully we're not one of them. Well then, how can we distinguish amongst them? Well, in part, we can do this by understanding the genre of apocalyptic. And that's what we're going to begin to do today. Now, we'll leave off, we'll put this on pause, and deal with some Advent text in weeks to come, too. But we'll take this up again then in January, with the book of Revelation in particular. But this is one of those texts that we need to understand before we get to Revelation. There are several like that. But this one we'll look at today. And we'll also see what the nature of apocalyptic is, so we can kind of anticipate what Revelation is going to be about as well. So let's look at Daniel 7, verses 1 through 8, shall we? Understanding this first point, apocalyptic. Understand that this genre employs vivid, imaginative metaphors to symbolize historical realities, lest apocalyptic become a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. Now, that last little bit is from, some of you will recognize that as when Winston Churchill was asked, what are the intentions of Russia, right, at one time, when just after he had given a speech on the Iron Curtain, calling that which had fallen around Russia in the 50s an Iron Curtain. And what are the intentions of Russia? And he said, the intentions of Russia are a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. I'm afraid Revelation is much like that for many people. So I borrowed that from Winston Churchill. So as we go through verses 1 through 8, understand that this is just classic picture of apocalyptic. This genre employs vivid imaginative metaphors to symbolize historical realities. Daniel 7, 1 through 8. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions of his head as he lay in his bed. Then he wrote down the dream and told the sum of the matter. Daniel declared, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. And four great beasts came up out of the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. Then as I looked, its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. And the mind of a man was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second one like a bear. It was raised up on one side. It had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and it was told, arise, devour much flesh. After this I looked, and behold, another like a leopard with 4 wings of a bird on its back. And the beast had 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a 4th beast, terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another horn, a little one, before which 3 of the 1st horns were plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. Well, in order to begin to understand Revelation and or Daniel, they're of the same genre, we must understand its genre. What is genre? Genre, of course, is a type or kind of writing. If you're going to understand any book of the Bible, you must first begin to understand its genre. We did this as we looked through the 66 books of the Bible in Sunday school some years back. One of the first questions we asked of every single book is, what is its genre? What is its type or kind of writing? So we have a working definition. This is a working definition I want to give you for apocalyptic. It's complex, but apocalyptic is a complex genre. So, a working definition of apocalyptic, a divine book made known through angels, dreams, and visions. a divine book made known through angels, dreams, and visions in the literary vehicle of a heavenly journey or a survey of history. Apocalyptic, in general, is a vehicle of a heavenly journey or survey of history. Communicated in esoteric language, bizarre imagery, and generally concluding in the cataclysmic end of all things. That's our working definition. I couldn't pare it down much more, except in my own offhand definition, apocalyptic is a divine revelation disguised as a fever dream. That's my own working simple definition. A divine revelation disguised as a fever dream. But there's several components here, isn't there? Heavenly journey, a book made known through angels, dreams, visions, bizarre imagery, esoteric language, concluding in the cataclysmic end of all things. And that really appeals to human imagination, human heart, doesn't it? Well then, if Daniel 7 is of the genre apocalyptic, then verse 1 anchors it in history. Very important point to make. Apocalyptic is anchored in history. In the closing days of the kingdom of Babylon, that is the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, who was the last king of Babylon preceding the Medo-Persian conquest, and see chapter 5 for that detail, Daniel receives this vision and dream. Now, some interpreters like to dissociate apocalyptic from history in order to make it applicable to all times and all places and to themselves. David Koresh, a famous egregious example of this. But you don't have to dissociate. And every time you do that, you risk the danger of going off the rails like David Koresh. But you don't have to dissociate a text like this to make it applicable for today. We can make it applicable by deriving the abiding principles at work in the text. That should always be our goal. In fact, to dissociate an apocalyptic text from its immediate historical context immediately destroys its meaning, sets you adrift. It becomes one of those be sure to drink your Ovaltine texts. John M. Court says this about the importance of staying historically grounded in an apocalyptic. He says, the vision of an alternative world in Revelation, or Daniel, for example, derives power from the contrast with the socio-political realities which produced it. In other words, you're anchored in history. He goes on to say, for literary tensions and theological dialectic to be fully understood, historical questions must remain part of the interpreter's task. We are anchored in history when we look at apocalyptic. So it is important to understand the historical realities behind the symbols created for us here. What are they? Let's look at a few of them. First of all, there are days of great political and cultural turmoil. That's the sense of verse 2. Keep your eyes in the text as we go through it. The sense of verse 2, where four winds of heaven, which symbolize all through Scripture turmoil and disorder from every quarter of the earth, the idea of the four winds of heaven converging here, were stirring up the sea. And of course, the sea has come to stand for humanity here, the general run of humanity from which we derive our Western expression, the sea of humanity, right? And as we shall see by examining each beast detailed below, the comings and goings of them created precisely these circumstances. Secondly, we see the rise and fall of great empires pictured in bizarre images. Rather than just naming names in a prosaic fashion like Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome, an apocalypse taps the imagination of the reader. That's one of the great benefits of apocalypse. It's pretty rollicking good reading, isn't it? Yeah. The apocalypse taps the imagination of the reader to portray the character and features of those kingdoms as well, by the symbols used to represent each. Now, which description more effectively brings home the power of what's described here? Obama violated the treaty clause of Article 1 of the Constitution with his deal with Iran, Article 1 of the Bill of Rights by jailing journalists, and the separation of powers of the Constitution by making legislation with executive orders. Which is more vivid to you, this or Obama shredded the Constitution like a rabid mad dog does a newspaper? Right? You've ever seen a dog tear up a newspaper? Just shred it and tear it up? That's a pretty vivid image. Well, apocalypse is the latter rather than the former. This is the modus operandi of apocalyptic. Consequently, four great beasts arising out of the sea conveys more power than the four empires of the first millennia BC, right? That's what you might hear in your ancient history class, right? But the apocalypse tells us of four great beasts arising out of the sea. That rivets my attention. These four empires are then delineated. Number one, Babylon, the lion with eagle's wings. That's in verse 4. As the gates of Ishtar testify, have you ever seen pictures of those? Maybe if you've been in Berlin, you've been able to visit the Pergamon Museum, where these gates were reassembled. But as the gates of Ishtar testify, Babylon identified itself with the eagle-winged lion, swift and fierce. And the plucked wings, lifted to stand like a man, is an allusion back to Daniel chapter 4. That is Nebuchadnezzar's humiliation and subsequent restoration, detailed back in Daniel chapter 4. In fact, the four kingdoms listed here are also a reprise of Daniel chapter 2, where the four kingdoms of the earth, the four glorious kingdoms of the earth, are given to us in Nebuchadnezzar's dream, finally dashed and destroyed by the kingdom of Christ to come, right? Well, the second empire delineated, Medo-Persia, the bear, verse 5. This was another self-identification of that kingdom. Medo-Persia identified itself as a bear. That it was raised up on one side is an allusion to the predominance of Persia in the alliance between the two kingdoms. And that it snacked on three ribs is an allusion to the three major kingdoms it overcame in rising to power. That is Babylon, Lydia, and Egypt, all conquered kingdoms of Medo-Persia. Our third empire, Greece, the leopard with four wings, in verse 6. If Babylon conquered with swiftness and ferocity, then the leopard, which is fast and cunning of itself with four wings, multiplied speed, conquered with heretofore unprecedented speed, the blitzkrieg, if you will, early blitzkrieg. And this was indeed the case with Alexander the Great, who conquered the known world by age 32. And his untimely death saw this vast kingdom divided among his four generals, accounting for the four heads amongst whom dominion was given subsequently. Getting all this, right? And then the fourth beast, Rome, a beast exponentially more bestial than the others, a bestial beast. Verses 7 and 8. As terrifying, dreadful, and strong as the previous three kingdoms were, to the superlative degree was this fourth beast, easily identified as Rome. Indeed, iron, and as the feet of iron and clay, right, the feet of iron and then the feet of iron and clay for that other kingdom that rose up amongst it in the image of Nebuchadnezzar's dream, Rome there, Rome here. Iron not only suffused its weapons and architecture, but its self-identified character, too. A distinguishing characteristic which set it apart from the others was its ten-horned head. And the little horn that springs up among the ten, only to display three, is a description of what? Da-da-da. You know, we're just going to leave you in a little suspense here as we do this. Let's leave a little mystery and drama for our study of Revelation, okay? Because John will pick up on this very chapter and this very image in his book, too. So you got to keep this one in mind. Bookmark this. Suffice it to know that these bizarre images, as we put them in our definition, these bizarre images will recur in the book of Revelation. John, depending upon the fact that you know not only this chapter, but the history of beasts from the sea, beginning with the beasts from the sea. Can you recall some of them, perhaps? We've already dealt with them a little bit. Say in our book of Job, right? Chapter 41 of Job. Can you draw out Leviathan with a fishhook? We saw that was a very seminal beginning, early employment of the beast from the sea. We also had a beast from the land as well in Job. Job sets the stage for all of these. And Leviathan, by this point, has become synonymous with evil, hasn't it? And the evil nations who oppressed God's people in particular. Isaiah 27, verse 1, puts it this way. In that day, the Lord with his hard and great and strong sword will punish Leviathan, the fleeing serpent. Leviathan, the twisting serpent. And he will slay the dragon that is in the sea. All of these images, right? Ripening by this point, right? In the book of Isaiah. Coming to fruition. And Daniel coming later, drawing upon them. And then also, Rahab, the river serpent, has become synonymous with Egypt. We saw this in our psalm reading this morning, right? As the nations were listed, David didn't even bother to interpret Rahab as Egypt because he expected you already to know precisely what he was listing when he listed Rahab. Go back and check that psalm out. Rahab, the river serpent, has become synonymous with Egypt. Isaiah says in chapter 30, in a scoffing, scorning kind of judgmental way, he says, Egypt's help is worthless and empty. Therefore, I have called her Rahab who sits still. Now, in Hebrew, that's a kind of rolls off the tongue in a kind of a rollicking, scoffing way. Rahab, that is Egypt, identified with this river serpent. So, Daniel is not writing in a vacuum. Virtually every generation of God's people have dealt with evil empires. We've just got four of them sampled here, who have oppressed and slaughtered them, attempting to crush the head of the seed of the woman from the Garden of Eden onward. You have the demonic sons of God going into the daughters of men in chapter 6 of Genesis, Rahab killing the males of Israel, the winged lion deporting the population, importing foreign seed. This bestial behavior reprises in full character the original beast, the serpent, who was more subtle than any beast of the field. You see the consistent pattern all through Scripture. Consequently, Daniel does not wake up one day and go to his cartoon drawing board and say, aha, I know what I'll do. I'll draw Babylon as a lion with wings. Yeah, that's it. How creative I am. Right? No, he was drawing upon stock images that his readers and us know already as vivid reference. Therefore, although our initial encounters with them may strike us as bizarre images, and to many who come to Revelation, the book of Revelation, fresh without having had any study of the Bible before, what's the first book that new converts go to? Right? The book of Revelation. Aha! Is Hillary Clinton really the Antichrist? Maybe, right? Maybe the European Common Union is the ten-headed beast of Revelation. You know, and they get all excited and without having known or studied that this bestial behavior reprises in full character of the original beast. Daniel was drawing on stock images, so was John. Known already as vivid reference. So, therefore, although our initial encounters with them may strike us as bizarre images, once we know how to interpret them historically, anchored in history, they lose their bizarre nature though not their vivid quality, right? They lose their bizarre nature as we come to know them historically, though not their vivid quality. They should always be vivid before us. It is exegetically irresponsible to go and tag Saddam Hussein as the Antichrist because he wanted to make Iraq like ancient Babylon. This has been done all through history. It is exegetically irresponsible to identify the European Union as the ten-headed beast from the sea because there were 10 nations comprising it. Well, then it kind of got away from us when there were 12 nations, and we quickly realized, no, probably not. As this process continues, as this understanding of Revelation continues, the Revelation red heifer rapture ranters have become dogs chasing their prophetic tails, drawing weak lessons and applications from strong imaginative texts. Had Daniel been amongst them at their prophetic conferences, he would have scratched his head and said, "How did you get that from what I wrote?" Well, if we aren't to treat the text in this fashion, then how are we to view it? Let's look to point 2, verses 9 to 14. And let's read verses 9 to 14 of Daniel 7. As I looked, thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames, its wheels were burning fire. A stream of fire issued and came out from before him. 1,000,000 served him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court sat in judgment, and the books were opened. I looked then because of the sound of the great words that the horn was speaking, and as I looked, the beast was killed, and its body destroyed, and given over to be burned with fire. As for the rest of the beast, their dominion was taken away, but their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven there came one like a son of man, and he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. In contrast to just what we've read about the earthly kingdoms, right? Well, that gives us point 2, apocalyptic. We are looking at the genre of apocalyptic. In this regard, understand that this genre employs an oscillation between heaven and earth. It's not random. It's not by the way. It's intentional. This genre employs an oscillation between heaven and earth to picture God's sovereignty, lest apocalyptic become a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. As happens here, characteristic of this genre is often a sudden change of venue and place. There will be a shift from the seeming hopeless circumstances on earth from the saints' perspective. In what John has just described, you see the hopeless situation of just this constant vicious cycle of earthly beasts that constantly predate upon the saints. Does it ever end? So from this perspective of the saints and from all others on earth, there's just this seemingly hopeless circumstance, and you are suddenly shifted to the spiritual realities from the heavenly perspective. And this is meant in the first instance to encourage the saints who are being oppressed by the bestial behavior of the nations. Meant in the first instance to not to wow us and to zing us and to say, "Oh, look at the grandstand stage that we're on." No, it's meant to encourage the saints who are being oppressed by the bestial behavior of the nations. Apocalyptic is given in desperate circumstances to give pause and perspective, to reassure us that although all seems lost as the beast is poised to devour, this is not the final scene of the drama. Although a horn, a symbol of power, right? David praises God in the Psalms for lifting up his horn, that is for elevating him to power and king, right? Though a horn may boast and bully, it itself will be destroyed. That is given over to be burned with fire. Throughout the centuries, not just here, not just in Revelation, throughout the centuries, this genre of the Bible has comforted suffering saints, killed and oppressed by their persecutors, and is doing so yet today. This is why it was given. Not to titillate and excite dilettantes and dabblers who want to entertain themselves by putting together mysterious puzzles of the future in lieu of paying an astrologer. Daniel comforted the saints of his day, John's day, and our day. And he does this majestically, doesn't he? Unbeknownst and unseen to all on the earth below, the Ancient of Days takes his place upon his regal throne to sit in judgment. Do you see all the images of power and majesty and sovereignty here? The Ancient of Days, clothing white as snow, hair of his head like pure wool. Where else will we see that? Book of Revelation, right? Throne, fiery flames, its wheels were burning fire. Ezekiel chapter 1. A stream of fire issued and came out from before him. 1,000,000 served him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court sat in judgment. Where does that remind you of, huh? Yeah, the prologue to Job, right? Book of Job. The sons of God, myriads upon myriads, standing before him. Court sat in judgment. That's precisely what was going through the trial, right? The patriarchal trial as well. And books were opened. We have here then the first indication, at least for us, in Apocalypse, of God's sovereign choice of his people, an assurance to his people. Continuing then his sight in night visions, Daniel sees a vision of the coming Christ in verses 13 and 14, one like a son of man, which will become Jesus' favorite self-designation too. Remember in our Wednesday night Bible study, we unpacked this whole idea of the son of man and Jesus' self-designation, his favorite self-designation. In fact, his use, Christ's use of this designation, was in the context of power and glory and judgment, too, not humility. Precisely as it's used here, right? Power, glory, judgment, and power. Well, was it, for example, what is it that caused the high priest to tear his robe and condemn Jesus? Jesus says in Matthew 26, Jesus said to him, "You have said so." That is, if you're the Messiah, openly declare it. Jesus said, "You have said so. But I tell you, from now on, you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven." What do you think text he was alluding to? This one, precisely here, isn't it? So, amidst the ebb and flow of chaotic kingdoms below on the earth, which Daniel has just reviewed for us, hasn't he? These four kingdoms that come in turmoil, stirring up the sea of humanity. Ebb and flow, what is it? When is it going to end? Will it ever end? This is what we see on the human side, the earthly side. Here, though, we are reassured that to this Son of Man was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. That's the ultimate purpose and goal of all of this. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away. Unlike these four we've just delineated in these beasts, right? And his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed, as these other four you see transpiring below have been, right? And will be. Well, with this understanding of oscillation between heaven and earth, you're going to see this all the way through Revelation. You'll say, "Oh, I know about this. I've been told about this." And it's meant to comfort the saints. It's meant to demonstrate God's sovereignty. You are now equipped with an understanding of one of the keys to understanding apocalyptic. And it's not a little orphan Annie ring either. It's a genuine biblical tool. Well, what else characterizes this genre? Point number three, verses 15 to 28. Let's read verses 15 to 28, shall we? As for me, Daniel, my spirit within me was anxious, and the visions of my head alarmed me. I approached one of those who stood there and asked him the truth concerning all this. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of the things. These four great beasts are four kings who shall arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, forever and ever. Then I desired to know the truth about the fourth beast, which was different from all the rest, exceedingly terrifying, with its teeth of iron and claws of bronze, and which devoured in broken pieces and stamped what was left with its feet, and about the ten horns that were on its head, the other horn that came up, and before which three of them fell, the horn that had eyes and a mouth that spoke great things and that seemed greater than its companions. As I looked, this horn made war with the saints and prevailed over them till the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was given for the saints of the Most High. And the time came when the saints possessed the kingdom. Thus he said, as for the fourth beast, there shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different from all the kingdoms, and it shall devour the whole earth and trample it down and break it to pieces. As for the ten horns, out of this kingdom, ten kings shall arise, and another shall arise after them. He shall be different from the former ones and shall put down three kings. He shall speak words against the Most High and shall wear out the saints of the Most High and shall think to change the times and the law. And they shall be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. But the court shall sit in judgment, and his dominion shall be taken away, to be consumed and destroyed to the end. And the kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. His kingdom shall be an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. Here is the end of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts greatly alarmed me, and my color changed, but I kept the matter in my heart. You see that there's four subpoints then underneath. Point three, apocalyptic. Understanding this genre employs an angelic guide to interpret what is revealed for the church, lest apocalyptic become a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. We have to have it interpreted, don't we? Well, A under three, apocalyptic. In cyclical fashion, very important. This is one of the techniques of apocalyptic, dealing in cycles. In cyclical fashion, an angelic guide gives the sum of Daniel's vision, the triumph of the saints in God's kingdom. Well, these vivid images, no longer bizarre, are they? But they're still vivid. Nevertheless, remain alarming to mere mortals, engendering great anxiety by their very nature. They're difficult to understand. They need interpretation. So Daniel tugs on the sleeves of one of the myriad of angelic beings and has explained to him for the remainder of the chapter the contents of the vision. It's important for him and for us, because it will characterize the modus operandi of apocalyptic henceforth. We are not left wondering its meaning. Daniel is given the essence of the vision in summary form. These four great beasts are four kings who shall arise out of the earth, but the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, forever and ever. The upshot, once again for the comfort of the church, is that the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever. That's the purpose. The upshot. It's not someday some clever preacher will connect these beasts with the Soviet Union, the European Union, and the United States. That's not the intent and the purpose and the upshot. And observe with me the cyclical nature of this genre. as Daniel and the angel come back around then to unpack the same information in greater detail. Subpoint B, apocalyptic. In cyclical fashion, once again, the angelic guide gives greater detail, revealing the suffering of the saints before their triumph. Note how Daniel's curiosity was piqued, verses 19 to 22. As no doubt the readers would be too. He desires to know more about the particularly nasty fourth beast. It seems really scary. No subject for the kids' bedtime story, is this? Here he isn't given answers per se, but has a further elaboration of its evil predations. Exceeding terrifying. Devoured, broken pieces, the horn greater than its companions, which made war of the saints, prevailed over them, right? But note also the further elaboration of the saints' possession. Until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was given for the saints of the Most High. And the time came when the saints possessed the kingdom. This is a technique of apocalyptic. The vision is covering the same ground as the previous verses, but with greater detail and elaboration each time. It's for our information and for our encouragement. So is its further elaboration in the next cycle, subpoint C. Once again, apocalyptic. This is characteristic of apocalyptic. It will be characteristic of Revelation. Unless you understand this, you won't understand Revelation and its cyclical pattern either. In cyclical fashion, the angelic guide gives further detail concerning the final beast that appears to triumph over God's kingdom, verses 23 to 27. Our angelic guide returns to first ground again, returns to first ground in describing the fourth beast as a fourth distinctive kingdom. But the detail is extensive this time. We see Rome's appetite for power, glory, and gain would be unstoppable as you cast your eyes over the verses. I'm not going to read them again, but you see Rome's appetite for power, glory, and gain would be unstoppable. And at her most extensive, she was comprised of 10 provinces, i.e. 10 heads. And then one emperor in particular would defeat 3 opponents and persecute the saints. Who do you think that might be? You better stay historically grounded if you're going to understand it, because the Apostle John will take up the same theme. And he didn't have in mind Henry Kissinger or Saddam Hussein or Hillary Clinton. There's a particular he had in mind. And then once more, we see in this text, reprised is the ultimate defeat of that kingdom now given over to the Son of Man. Important for our purposes in Revelation is not only the foreshadowing done here, taken up later in the book of Revelation, but also the mode of operation, the modus operandi, that is that of cycles. Then lastly, Daniel is left pale and perplexed. Subpoint D. In cyclical fashion, Daniel concludes his distressing vision the same manner in which he began it. Now, as happens with all recipients of an apocalypse, Daniel is left pale and alarmed and speechless, isn't he? Much as the oppressed saints for whom apocalypse is given. Remember, this is our original audience. Not a bunch of dilettantes with popcorn watching CDs on the book of Revelation. It was given for the persecuted church. Israel here was oppressed in captivity, asking, what of God's promises? Much the same as Job was asked. In fact, there are those who say that apocalyptic is an elaboration of wisdom literature, i.e. like Job. We've already seen some of the parallels. As tumultuous and distressing as the times, so is apocalyptic. Meant to be. Meant to match the times. Apocalypse is not for dilettantes and dabblers. Apocalypse is a gift of grace and mercy for those desperate and destitute of hope. Desperate for and destitute of hope. This is for whom Apocalypse is written. Not for dilettantes and dabblers and prophetic church. The book of Revelation, the book of Daniel, has always been a go-to book throughout the history of the church. A go-to book in times of persecution. I remember ministering with a Romanian doctor who spent his life behind the Iron Curtain. One of his favorite books of great comfort for him and for his people and for his church was the book of Revelation. The book of Revelation was a great comfort for the crusaders in the Holy Land as they were suffering and persecuted by Islam. One of my favorite CDs is The Music of the Crusades. I saw that CD and I said, I got to get that. And the subject of many of the hymns and many of the chants for The Music of the Crusades is the book of Revelation. It was the book of the radical reformers too, as they were persecuted not only by the Roman Catholic Church, but also by the reformers themselves for some of their outlandish interpretations of Revelation. The book of Revelation was so much a book of the radical reformers, it caused a reaction by the more level-headed reformers like Luther and Calvin. But the book of Revelation has always been a book of the saints in times of persecution. Apocalypse is a gift of grace and mercy. Daniel, Revelation, a gift of grace and mercy for those desperate for and destitute of hope, because it gives us hope. And in that gift of grace and mercy, Christ is offered, as we've seen, isn't he? In that gift of grace and mercy, Christ is offered, even here, that is the Son of Man. Well, with this in mind, equipped now with some tools to interpret Apocalypse, let us now come to that place where we see the glorious Son of Man in that which earned him that power and glory. That is the sacrifice of his body and blood as emblemized in the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.